Hi, this is Andrew Keats, and my job is essentially to tell actors where to stand and to be a little bit louder. And you're listening to the Warm Blanket Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Warm Blanket Podcast, where we embark on a journey to see what makes us feel good about Star Trek, where is our love comes from, and what it means for us. In short, what is our warm blanket? My name is Gary, and I'm your host, and I'm very honored to welcome here my special guest today, award-winning theater director, LGBTQ plus activist Andrew Keats, who also happened to be the host of the hugely successful The Show People podcast. His recent work show at Dark Sublime was an instant hit, featuring the wonderful Marina Sirtis from Star Trek The Next Generation. We are going to talk about that and more in just in a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give a very warm welcome to Mr. Andrew Keats. How are you today, sir?
I'm well. I'm just looking for this audience that should be applauding now for such a lovely I'm always weird when people tell me all the things I've done and I listen and go, oh, that guy sounds great. And then it's even weirder when you realize it's you. Gary, thank you for having me on your lovely show. How much I've been looking forward to getting in a warm blanket with you.
Well, thank you very much for having being in the show. And obviously, what I just said, it's a great honor to have you here. And it's part of it that I just said is it's not even scarring the surface. It's not even it's just barely the surface. I can't even talk after a long night, a long day of shifts. But yeah, it's just really just surface, the tip of the iceberg. Let's just say that. How are you doing? How is everything in the life of theater at the moment?
Well, Gary, I don't know what adult rating this podcast is, but I think I can sum it up by saying it's shit. You know, and all joking aside, you know, I've dedicated 15, 20 years of my life to the theater, and within a matter of months, my entire industry, along with plenty of others, but the thing I can speak on authority is the theatre industry has been decimated across the world, and in this country in particular, we have gone through months and months and months without any sign of government support until recently, where there has been some investment from the government. And sadly, I can't really comment too much on what this Tory government, what that funding is going to enable us to do, because we don't know how that's going to trickle down. But in actuality, you know, every single show or project that I was lined up to do the rest of this year and early next year has, of course, been cancelled because of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And I'm spending a lot of time speaking with producers, artistic directors, theatre makers, about ways that we can be as creative and innovative as we can to try and protect theatre. But we're already seeing theatres closing that will never reopen again. We're seeing some of our finest institutions going bankrupt or going into administration. And, you know, it's important, you know, when people think of the arts or theatre, you know, like it's a job, right? You know, at the end of the day, it's a job. It's not like some, you know, people on Twitter sometimes call us, you know, these lefty lovies or these arty types. Actually, it's a job. It pays my mortgage and it pays other people's mortgages and their families. And actually, there are a lot of artists who are my friends, not just my mates, who I'm spending a lot of time listening to them, either through their tears or their panic laughter, worrying about what they're going to do for their families. And we really haven't seen much like this on this level to impact the industry. But of course, we could go far back. We could go back and discuss, you know, the plague. You know, that was the last time. And the plague bailed out. That's something people forget. We had the King's Men and theatres, or theatre companies were bailed out during the plague. Of course, there was the 1980s AIDS epidemic. But really close theatres then, loads of people died. But this particular pandemic just seems so all-encompassing because it affects anyone. It's indiscriminate.
It is indeed. But on that note, let's dive into a little bit of a past, because, you know, a couple of years ago we had some happy memories, and let's indulge ourselves in a few good things just to, you know, cope with the situation. That's what I normally do when something happens like this, which never happened in my lifetime, so I'm quite lucky that this is the first one. Hopefully this will be the last one too. So I think we got to, we met about 2 years ago or 3 years ago in one of the sci-fi ball convention in Southampton.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago now. And I've been always wondered, how long you've been part of the organization, and how does it make to come up with an event like this?
Well,
the organization behind.
That is a great question, Gary. And knowing there is obviously a microphone on me and a camera, I haven't actually. This will be an exclusive for your podcast, I suppose, because I haven't.
Every episode is an exclusive.
Is it?
Of course.
I sort of announced a year ago, 2 years ago now. That not only was I not going to be involved with the sci-fi board anymore, but I also no longer support it in any way, shape, or form. I have completely cut ties with the directors of that particular mm-hmm. organization, because in short, they treated me abysmally. Mm-hmm. I had grown up knowing these people, in particular the directors, the organizers, since I was a little boy. You know, one of the directors was in many ways like a father figure. And, you know, when you're growing up as a kid without a dad, as I was, and from a single parent mom on a council estate, connecting into this warm blanket idea that you've got, I was gay, I was fat, I had a terrible speech impediment, and I knew I was gay and I needed some way to escape. But I would look at the television, and there were no gay characters, or if we were there, we were either, you know, dying of AIDS, slitting our wrists, or we were comic. Mm-hmm. And so it's no wonder that science fiction in particular was an extraordinary escape route for me. And in particular Star Trek, especially the movies. It's the movies that I'm a real big fan of. And especially The Wrath of Khan, which I hope we'll get onto, or The Wrath of Khan, if you're listening in the UK. Anyway, through that, there was a science fiction society, you know, and I met these extraordinary people. And interestingly, so many people who were a part of that, that also committed to these people that run that organization, are also not there anymore. And it's very interesting, you know, I grew up there. I got a lot of confidence. I got a lot of life experience. It felt then very much like a family. And then you know, I would go off to the various drama schools that I trained at, and then I ran my own theater. And, you know, by virtue of fortunately being, and I use this term with a grimace, a successful theater director, what was sort of extraordinary is so many of the people that I looked up to, particularly in television and film, I would then end up working with, or they became mates by virtue of me being in London, places I go, things I worked on. You know, when you start working on the things you care about, you end up attracting the same people that have the same ideals, and, you know, working with, whether they be actors to playwrights, to producers, to whatever. And I wanted to give something back to those guys. You know, I have a successful production company, I have access to some really lovely talent, and I really thought back to the guys that it was called the Starfleet Ball, but they got into trouble with the copyright, so they changed it to the Starfleet. But then the SF Ball, and then they changed it to the Sci-Fi Ball. I mean, good lord, it's had more names than
always under new management, right?
Well, it's had more names than what was her name? Sinead O'Connor. But look, at the end of the day, you know, I came back, and, you know, it was apparent they were in a lot of financial difficulty, and it was presented to me that there was problems with the way the organization was run, and there were people involved in it bad, you know, and me and my then fiance at the time came in and tried to help and tried to, you know, bring it together a bit more like a business. And I helped bring in a lot of money for them. That was the real thing I did for them, a lot of money through sponsors. And then you know, then it turned into this all-encompassing thing where every day I was sort of working and working and working with very little sort of thanks. And then it was just no... I don't want to call it bullying, because it wasn't bullying. It was such a lack of respect, such a condescending tone from people that really didn't know how to treat people well. Mm-hmm. And I was... Maybe it was Star Trek that did it. Definitely my mum. You know, I've always been brought up, you know, treat as you find and respect people, and there's no such bad idea. And eventually... the way I was being spoken to by the powers that be just made me go, I'm worth more than this. Indeed, some of the talent that I brought in had commented and said, why on earth do you hate it? Would you work with these people? And so I washed my hands, and it was before I resigned, I got a phone call from one of my sponsors, saying, because it was clear I was going to go. It was clear. It was a terrible weekend. And I got a phone call saying, well, we've been approached by the guys at Sci-Fi 4. We just think it's a bit weird, seeing as they're my you know, client for various things. Mm-hmm. And I then got a phone call from the Anlinda, whatever she wants to call herself, Commandant, let's say that. And she said, just so you know, I've spoken to the Horror Channel. And I was like, oh, great. So rather than looking at, see if I'm okay, you've gone for the money before you contact me, have you? And that was where I knew how kind that person was. And lastly, I've met up with quite a few people from the book. I've got a lot of friends there, you know. And this one particular member of the crew said, how do you feel? And I said, at the end of that weekend, I felt like I was walking out into the middle of the road, and the two main people that ran it said, quick, get his wallet before he's hit by a car. And I'm very, very upset. But I'm still healed from it. But it's a shame, because those people were very important to me growing up. But, you know, at the end of the day, an amateur organization is an amateur organization, and people for the love, but ultimately everybody's time is precious. And I don't have any regrets for what I did for them all. Wish them all the best. My time was almost over.
Oh wow, it was like quite a drama behind the curtains there.
and there doesn't need to be drama, because I'm not being funny. You know, I've worked on shows with really big people and very, very big budgets that can potentially lose money, and I've been in more stressful situations, but I haven't had that personal stab. I haven't had that stab in the before. That was a first in my life. So, but anyway, moving
as a fan, like, you know, like, regardless, and I do appreciate that you share this information and this behind the scene facts about the organization and the convention itself. But I keep wondering, as a fan, as you mentioned, you being a Star Trek fan, and we're going to talk about this in a minute. But I wonder when you got into the organization, you started approaching actors, you know, coming to the convention, and, you know, organizing the whole thing. Have you ever got starstruck by any point? Like, hey, there's Dominic Keating, or like, hey, there's, I mean, William Shatner, or like, you know, have you got ever starstruck by these people?
That Dominic Keating. this is just by audio. Dominic is one of my very best mates. He's kind of like a brother to me. We speak most weeks. That's actually, for those who are listening, going, what is he showing? It's just a photo of me and Dominic.
It's just a photo. Audience cannot see it, but I can. It's amazing.
There you are. It's just sharing a Guinness in a pub in Tooting. I'll be honest with you, with actors, very rarely. Because I'm not, again, I don't want to come across like a bit of a dick, but I am friends with some of the most famous people in the world, but I'm not friends with them because they're famous. I'm friends with them because we've got something in common. You know, we either look at life similarly, or, you know, and actually, I don't know. The closest thing I've come to starstruck has never been someone involved in a sci-fi show. The closest thing to starstruck has always been certain writers. That's been where I've tripped over my words, because I've been anxious. Because I suppose from training as an actor and being a director and a producer, I sort of know what they're doing. You know, like acting is not impressive to me. It's something I understand. Mm. It is, you know, I appreciate it. Of course I do. And I know when it's good. Mm-hmm. But there are certain plays, plays like Bent by Martin Sherman, As Is by William M. Hoffman, you know, plays that when I was a young gay kid, you know, most gay kids keep things under their bed that they don't want their parents to find. For me, it's plays by gay authors. And it was when I started to direct and work on plays written by the voices who kept me alive as a bullied teenager. Mm-hmm. 1928, which was the non-promotion of homosexuality in schools in this country. Mm-hmm. It was when Martin Sherman, I was starstruck to the point that was quite tricky with words, because I read his play Bent at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then after I read it, I walked into my mum's bedroom with a cup of tea, and I woke her up and I told her I was gay. I mean, that play changed my life. And then years later, before I would then end up co-running the Landor Theatre in South London, when I met Martin, and we've since worked together, and he's very much my mentor now. I still get little moments, you know. We'll be having him for years now, and we WhatsApp each other stupid things and things. And now it's, you know, there are times we'll be at dinner, and he'll say something, and he'll look at me, and I have to say, "You're sat with your hero." Mm-hmm. And that's a man called Martin Sherman, a playwright who may not mean anything to listeners here, but he was my hero. But then I suppose, on the other hand, having a fag with a certain Green Assertus whilst direct Dark Sublime, she was my leading lady. She wasn't, you know, that woman from Star Trek, you know. And Marina Sirtis is, bringing it back to the Star Trek side of things, you know, Marina Sirtis is a woman that I love and admire, who happened to be in Star Trek, in the same way that Dominic Keating is that bloody crafty git who always phones me and says, can I stay on your sofa for a couple of weeks? Yes, go on then, Dom. You know, but it's the strange thing. The strangest thing when I said to Connor Trinneer, it was Connor Trinneer I said this to, and this was at the Sci-Fi Ball. I didn't really watch Enterprise until those lads were coming. I was like, well, I should at least watch the episodes, you know, so I got something to at least, if somebody comes and says, who is this character, I should at least know who they are. And I remember I was sat with Connor, and he was signing autographs. He was having a tough time at the time. And I remember people were bringing these signed photos over, and it was Connor in his spacesuit, you know. Cool. And he still is gorgeous, if he's listening. He was absolutely gorgeous. And more chiseled than the Venus de Milo and Michelangelo Davis. But I said to him, I said, is that hard? So what do you mean? And I said, like, looking at that 20-something year old actor all these years later, and he went, you have no idea. That's why I'm a director, because I don't think I don't think just a sci-fi fan would consider that. I think I was looking in the eyes of someone who had recently graduated drama school, had his whole world ahead of him, and here he is sat with me in bloody Southampton on a rainy day, you know. And it's very interesting, my perspective. So yes, it is really lovely at times when if I could go back and meet the fat me in a, you know, sat watching Next Generation videos and say, guess what, not only are you going to have a career in the theatre, but you're going to end up paying the wages of some of the actors from that show, I'm sure I wouldn't believe it. But equally, and as Dark Sublime, the play I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, investigate, it's Star Trek was another job. I'm aware of that quantification. It was another job that people find very, very inspiring. But actually, the thing that really excites me is if I hear that Dominic's got an audition for something. Way more excited for Dominic than whether he's doing a convention, or Marina's got something coming up, or like recently, certain people have had some really terrible personal news. Mm-hmm. You know, just checking in with them that way, because it might have been Star Trek that we met, but my relationships with a lot of these people are, let's say, far beyond the stars, let's say that.
it really boils down to the fact, and just listening to you and your perspective of the whole situation and the whole interaction between these stars who we fans like sometimes even not just idolize but iconize as well. Yeah. It is interesting to hear the other side, because they are basically doing their job, putting, you know, learning their lines, doing their stunts and everything for entertaining us, and the same way as you know, we put the effort into to, you know, making graphics to the website or I don't know, make a cup of coffee in a coffee shop. Obviously the pay differences are a bit different, but at the end of the day they are just normal human beings who we see them on screen, and they seen us in the coffee shop in the morning, so it's good to hear the, you know, the other side of the story.
I mean, as someone who likes, you know, I grew up at conventions, and mm-hmm. I listen to some really great actors, a lot of really great British actors that come to mind. I like to think they're a little bit like fans and Star Trek actors, or indeed any sci-fi actors. Mm-hmm. Star Trek in particular is so big, but it's a little bit like Greek mythology. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's almost preserving this perception of them as gods, you know, and
yes.
And from there comes all this iconography and this culture and this folklore surrounding these people, you know. I mean, Sci-Fi Ball was amazing. It doesn't matter, I don't work for anymore, say what I like. You know, it was amazing when I would mention certain actors and then this deafy silence would come, oh no, we can't have them, can't possibly have them, they're a nightmare. And they've never worked with them, you know. Just this is folklore about these actors because they had heard that such and such was this. And you just want to go, but it's meant to be a sort of convention business. Like, just book them and find out. You know, if they're a nightmare, don't get them back. And actually, they're people. People change. Good Lord, that's the case. and I think the other thing as well is like the... I've noticed it when I've again been with friends who have been guests at conventions. You know, mm-hmm. there is they give. I don't think I know anyone who gives more of themselves at a convention than it's probably Marina, I would say, mm-hmm. because she gives. You know, and what, you know, she has whole relationships with her fans. She's so respectful. I mean, when we did Dark Sublime, this play in the West End that she was the lead mm-hmm. in, you know, her fans travelled from all over the world. And I have nothing but respect for that love and adoration. And they were there. Some of them saw the play, you know, 6-7 times. And it was lovely. Me and one of the producers, Piers Cotty-Jones, he's one of my very best mates. You know, we were running the social media for nearly a year. And we got to know so many people from the Star Trek universe and have conversations with them. We would see them at the theatre. There'd be hugs because actually the thing and the play... Dark Sublime by Michael Dennis, the thing that it really looks at is the similarity between fan love and unconditional love, and both the highs and the lows that come with that. Because sometimes with an unconditional love, there can be quite unrealistic expectations. But there is that unconditional love that people will do anything. And it's a really fascinating thing to look at. I squirm when I hear the old, you know, William Shatner on Saturday Night Live, you know, get a life sort of comment.
Yeah,
I understand where that comes from though, because it's just a TV show. But yeah. That doesn't mean to say, look, I care more about Star Trek than I care about the Bible, you know, and I think people do more fanatical things in the name of Christ than Star Trek fans.
Of course. You know?
And personally, I think Star Trek has a more believable plot, but although both figure a man with pointy ears, I might add. But you know, like that's the point. It's one of the stories that get you through life. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'd be lying if there aren't days where I'm a little bit hungover, and I'll pull on my t-shirt and pajama bottoms and shove on an episode of Star Trek, drink a cup of tea Earl Grey hot, and it's no different to when, you know, when early man sat around a campfire and told stories about the gods. You know, it's a lovely thing. It's a lovely thing.
I think that's one of the most beautiful thing that someone said so far that I heard about, you know, how you watch Star Trek. Like, that is beautiful. Awesome.
you know, have upset every Christian that listens to your show as well. So I apologize, but you know.
This show we've been no means we try to, you know, disrespect anyone. This is a very respectable show, and
it's not meant to be disrespectful.
So I think we circled around the topic quite a lot. So I think it's only fair to ask, how, when, or rather, how did you get into Star Trek?
How did I get into Star Trek?
Or when?
Bullying, really. When I was, I'm 34, I think. I'm either 34 or 35, I forget my age. I think I'm 34. I'm pretty sure I'm 34. I forget it all the time, it's a nightmare. Especially during this time. Yeah, I think I'm 34. I would have started watching Star Trek maybe when I was about 11, 12, 13. I'd say that was when I started watching. But don't forget, that was during a time when we had like 4 or 5 TV channels, you know? Mm. So, I mean, I remember the BBC doing Star Trek Night, for example, you know, and a new series was, they were showing the pilot of this brand new series called Star Trek Voyager. You know, all of that was new, and there was Star Trek magazine, and I was this fat little kid who didn't really fit in to a Tory Christian conservative Bournemouth. I was a fat gay kid who loved the arts, loved music, loved poetry, was very, very sensitive, was growing up on a council estate with a single parent East End mum, and I didn't see anyone like me. So instead, if there's no one like you on the street, I looked to space and found that my morality and my ideals and my views of acceptance and kindness were more in keeping with the writing of Gene Roddenberry than it was perhaps with what my teachers and a lot of the people who held my assemblies at school were. I was very badly hospitalized when I was growing up through homophobic thing. And you know, when you realize that if you go to the playground, you know, you can end up in a CT scanner with hematomas and your eye socket nearly crushed, you don't want to go to the playground anymore. But I did like the idea of staying in bed with a warm duvet or blanket, depending on the warm blanket for this podcast, you know, with a mug of tea, watching VHS tapes of this, you know, Trek Through the Stars. And it wasn't just Star Trek, if I'm honest with you. I didn't have posters of Captain Kirk on my wall. That wasn't the case. I think now I have a Wrath of Khan poster up in my corridor that was given to me. I love Quantum Leap. I love Doctor Who. I said the other day on Twitter, I think if Quantum Leap was made compulsory viewing for everybody in the world, I think the world would be a kinder place. Because I honestly think that the troubles in the world at the moment is this enormous lack of empathy and this enormous lack of kindness and this enormous lack of my philosophy that, you know, that you, that by helping others, you will always get something in return. That's not what you should do it, but you know, like, collaboration is the key to making anything, whether that's a theatre to a successful family. You know, if you and I don't sit chatting on this podcast, you don't have a podcast, I have a quiet evening. You know, the potential that we have as creative people to make shit happen is phenomenal. But the problem is people think that doing something, they're losing something. Why should I do that? Why should I do that? You think, well, it's because you just don't understand the way the universe can work. I'll tell you something. During this lockdown, I mean, I live on my own. My industry has been decimated, as I said, you know. And I had my days. funny enough, on my sofa, feeling miserable, worrying about money. Everyone's worrying about money right now, I'm sure of it. I certainly am. And then I got out my iPad and I was like, because I was fed up watching television, if you can believe such a thing. I was fed up watching television, I was fed up listening to the radio, I wanted silence, I couldn't work with actors. I wanted to do something creative. So I sat down with my iPad and I started drawing. And I just thought to myself, this is so lovely. I'm just drawing for myself and I was really enjoying it. Anyway, I finished it off and I was so proud of it. I thought to myself, I know what I'll do. I'll get it printed. I'll use the British printing company that I use for my show posters and programs and whatever. And I printed it and I was really, really chuffed. And the thing that I drew was this. I may show you. You may have seen it on my Twitter.
And I'm probably not sure if anyone familiar with that, but that is the Mr. Spock looking at James T. Kirk with the Vulcan salute from Star Trek to the Wrath of Khan.
Specifically, Gary, what can't they do in that moment? What is the thing that breaks our heart? What is the thing that breaks our heart? As Spock is dying,
Be and always will be your friend.
But if your best friend is dying in front of you, there's one thing separating them throughout the whole thing. It breaks my heart. Think very literally, Gary.
Is there the glass wall?
There's a big piece of glass. They can't physically touch each other. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was drawing this out of this COVID-19 pandemic because I missed physically touching my mates. I felt lonely. And the thing that came to mind is probably the greatest bit. I think it's the greatest scene in all of Star Trek history. So I drew it. And I was very proud of it. And it went up on my wall. And then one of my best mates came around and he went, "Oh, I love that. Can I get one?" I was like, "Oh yeah, well, I'd have to get some more printed." So I ordered, I don't know, I ordered ten. First one was 10. I ordered 10 prints. And I just put it on Facebook and Twitter and just went, "I'm an artist. I physically can't do my job, but I would like to make this piece of art. And, you know, if you would like to buy it, you helping me pay my food bill." And then the Star Trek community did what the Star Trek community I've seen do time and time again. I've had orders from all over the world. I've actually just got another order in. Every day I've been wrapping up prints, hand signing them, writing thank you cards. They've been sent to Germany, they've been sent to Switzerland, loads in America, Wales, Scotland. And I think it's because that scene really resonates with all of us. The, you know, I'll be your friend, yes, but also just feeling terribly separated. And what I'm trying to get at there is I made something that I love, a scene I love, and that love is universally shared around the world. And I rather like that actually by being a bit creative, and putting that artwork together, that now my little idea of being creative will be hung on walls all over the world. And I rather love that. Again, making a living out of something that I love very passionately and love very much.
And that is amazing. It is a fantastic piece of art, and the notion behind it is quite remarkable as well.
Thank you.
So I do have to ask, being a Star Trek fan, yourself, I guess mainly TNG, I think I can say that, right?
It's not my favorite show.
Really?
Marina, but Next Gen is not my favorite show.
Oh my, tell me more.
She called me out on Twitter once. I can't remember. I think that was it. I was, I did a screenshot that I bought a new telly. That's it. I bought a brand new telly, brand new 4K telly. And I sent a screenshot. This is before lockdown. And I sent a screenshot of me saying, greatest Star Trek film ever made. And it was, surprise, surprise, The Wrath of Khan, or Wrath of Khan, depending on where you are in the world. And Marina saw it and retweeted and just went, "Traitor!" Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. So what do I love? I love the films, the first six films, even the motion picture to some extent. It's not first on my watch, but it is in there. The first six films are my love. I can quote those inside now. For me, the best writing of the whole franchise was Deep Space Nine. I think, of course, which of course it's going to be my favorite show. I mean, Star Trek was all about, you know, that journey out into the stars. For me, Deep Space Nine, this is my friend Armin Shimerman always puts it, was a journey inside. You know, Deep Space Nine, you know, a lot of people are like, oh my God, a space station, how boring, it's not going to go anywhere. Sure, but funny enough, the conceit of having a group of people stuck in one place is fundamentally what most about. And I actually think you have some of the very best acting the franchise ever saw in Deep Space Nine. Of course, I love The Next Generation. Of course, well, I love Series 4 onwards of The Next Generation. I have a real soft spot for the original series and everything it's trying to, in particular when it comes to racial equality. Mm-hmm. It's tough watched now sometimes when you look at the way that women are portrayed. Mm-hmm. We have to acknowledge that. But I also like the fact that that show and that franchise has owned it and said, okay, well, now we have Janeway. Do you know what I mean? I like the fact that the show is constantly evolving. Some fans can't deal with it. Voyager has some great moments. I mean, but Voyager is basically The Next Generation with the lights off, isn't it? and then, you know, I enjoy Discovery. I think Picard is a masterpiece. And if I can tell you something, coming back to Marina, because she's my only real direct link to it. So Marina finished Dark Sublime on the Saturday night, whatever the date was. And then she was flying back to America on the Sunday to start filming Picard on the Monday. Mm-hmm. And bless her. She literally went from, you know, her final performance, so many tears, cast saying goodbye. Then she went out, then she filmed. And then I got the terrible news, and she's been very open about this, so I feel comfortable to share. Then I got the terrible news that her husband had passed away. And I hurt on a level the worst news. I checked in and this is why sometimes the Star Trek thing really is so small in regards to the relationship, because I mean I got in touch, I said, do you want me to get on a plane? And I thought just turning up, you know, just had this thing of, do I just get on a plane? I'll just turn up. But then you think, what state she's in, I don't know if she's with her brother or not. And anyway, we were in touch, of course, and then Picard happened, and I was at the Picard premiere. I caught up with some people there, and then I kind of knew what Marina was doing in it, but when Picard finally aired in the UK, I was at home on my own, and oh, it's lovely, the show. I just realized this has the, you know, talks about the warm hug that you say. You know, all that time had passed, and when Marina came on stage, in shot, and threw her arms around Patrick, I can only say it's all I wanted to do to Marina, because I knew that literally only days before we'd done that show, I'd known all that she'd been through, and in many ways that this is very meta and ethereal, but to see her, to see Patrick give her that hug, in many ways was almost like me being able to do that to her from afar. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, the Sci-Fi Ball came up, of which she was a special guest. I was obviously going, and made obviously a very special trip. Spend a few days with us in London, and we did mention the Sci-Fi Ball once. It wasn't important, and she walked. It was in, I'm a member of the club called the Groucho Club, and the whole cast got together. She walked in. We could hear her bloody heels from about 10 meters away. Clip clop. Oh, I knew it was you lot. She saw us all, and I think within 3 seconds we were all in tears. Just a cast reunited, and that cast was so special, and you know, and mentioning. and let's be, I want to be honest as well, in regards to the sci-fi fans listening, why is he going on about this play, you know? I mean, Marina is an icon, don't get me wrong, in sci-fi, but so are some of the other cast, you know? Mark Guinness was in it, we obviously from Sherlock, we had Jacqueline King, who is Catherine Tate's mum, Donna Noble's mum in Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
King. We had Sophie Ward, you know, who's sort of iconic lesbian activist, author, was in brilliantly in Return to Oz, as well as lots of work as Disney as a little girl. Simon Thorpe, who has more RSC credits probably than Patrick Stewart. You know, and Kwaku Mills, this phenomenal young actor that we discovered, who I still maintain is the finest young actor I've ever given a job to. And here we were telling Michael Dennis's wonderful story about older lesbians. And it was the only lesbian play in the West End. And secondly, had these undertones of the relationship between a science fiction fan and a fan. And I remember when Marina's heard me say this story a million times, but I remember saying, you know, Marina and I met at a convention ages ago, just immediately. Within 5 minutes, we were having a fag, and then 10 minutes, she was saying the play. And then I was finding stuff for her. And Gates, we found actually. I was looking for stuff for Gates as well. We still haven't found some for Gates. Then I found this play, sent it to her, and we were chatting on the phone, and we were talking about how we're going to raise money and boring stuff like that. And then the phone went. She'd obviously read it. And the first thing Marina says to me on the phone is, "It's my fucking life." And I went, "Hi, love." Did he write it for me? I went, might as well have done. And I mean, there's so many parallels. There are so many parallels. You know, and you should talk to her about those, because that's her stories to tell. And her character was called Marianne. You know, and it was about an actor getting older who had once been on a TV show. And she flew herself over. She worked for hardly anything. But my God, she had a West End debut at 61. And I'm very proud of her. I'm proud of the whole cast. And I have a friendship with somebody that means a very great deal. And more importantly, I have great respect for. But like I said at the beginning, happened to have been in Star Trek to be. But really, it's the capital letter at the beginning of the sentence of our friendship.
It's almost like hearing these stories from, like, I remember watching an interview with Kate Mulgrew when she auditioned for Voyager. She had no idea what Star Trek is, and like, it's in the other side as well. Like, you know, you're basically so close to her, and like, Star Trek it comes in a 25th stage in the relationship. Like, it's not really the person who been in the show; it's the person itself. That matters, and it's a beautiful thing, and I think, you know, that's how it should be. Not loving someone because, hey, you did this, not loving someone because, you know, you're an awesome person.
You remind me of Robbie Duncan McNeil is somebody that whenever he's in the UK we spend time together. And Robbie, last time I saw Robbie in London, there was a picture of him as Tom Paris. And I said to him, I said, "Do you know what's really funny?" And I said, "I just don't recognize you." And I think he said to me, at the time, he went, "Why, because I got fat?" I went, "No." I said, like, when I think of Robert, I mean, it's Robert Duncan McNeil is how he's his stage name, isn't it? And like, I'm, you know, that guy, that young, gorgeous guy out of, he went to Juilliard, I think. You know, I'm sure he was a lovely guy. But the Robert Duncan McNeil I know is sort of, again, I know he did Star Trek, but we talk about film and food and like, and Trump, and like, it's not again, it's weird, it's weird if an episode of Voyager comes on, and of course I've seen Voyager, but that's Robert Duncan McNeil at that time when he's recording that show just doesn't have the same twinkle in his eye as the Robert Duncan McNeil I don't think he has. I don't think he's got the sense of humor. I don't think he's had the heartbreak. I don't, well, you know, like, we're all different people at different times in our life, you know.
And that comes with the Doctor Who. I just had to plug it in. You remember Matt Smith's regeneration speech at the end? We're all different people all through our lives. Wonderfully put together.
absolutely. And you mentioned Matt. Matt is somebody I see a lot in Soho, you know. But I directed a play called Passing By, which had James Cartwright in, son of the playwright Jim Cartwright, and Rick McCarran, who was in Torchwood, believe it or not, I would then later discover, which I didn't realize at the time. Rick, sorry, you're going by the must be by the proper name, stage names. Rick, I remember when Matt was like, can my friend Smith Dog come see your play? And I went, yeah, sure. And he went, but the problem is I've got to find a quiet place for him. I said, why is that? He went, because he's Doctor Who. I said, oh, you mean Matt Smith? He went, aye. You know, and you meet Matt and he's a cracking bloke, a lad. I've never met anyone more unlike the Doctor. If you're talking about Doctor Who, on Thursday I was having lunch with a friend of mine, Sean Pertwee. Sean is son of John Pertwee. But we didn't talk about Doctor Who. If I'm not going to tell you what we were talking about, it was filthy. But, you know, like, at the end of the day, we're a London creative community. And, you know, there are people who I've met who have hooked on the Doctor Who, Star Trek, whatever. They've nibbled on that salary. And then they've swam off and done theatre, and they've swam off and done a film. And you know, we're all feeding from the same pond. And actually, idolisation isn't helpful, because fundamentally, as a director, a director and a good friend as well, it's not about idolising your friends. It's about facilitating and helping them get from one place to another, whether that's getting them from a sad place to a happy place, to just giving them the space to talk and letting you listen.
I think that was an interview, I think in the 70s or 80s with Jimmy Doohan in a British TV that I happened to watch a couple of years ago. And it was interesting what he said, that because of Star Trek, he was actually not getting too much acting jobs, because it's like he walked into every single office and it's like, oh, Mr. Scott. And it's like, oh, Mr. Scott. It's like, and he was saying that, like, by that time when someone looked at me with big eyes and said, Mr. Scott, I knew I'm not going to get that job. And it was so hard for him to break out from. I don't think he ever broke out from Mr. Scott itself. Even he had a cameo in Knight Rider, the movie, in Knight Rider 2000. And he was Mr. Scott there too.
Yes, you're right. And actually, there are some actors where I've asked them, I'm not going to name any names here. There are some actors I've known. I said, "Would you do Star Trek again?" And they've gone no, because they were young, they were offered a ton of money, and they were ready to do that and then have the springboard into whatever. And actually, that springboard never came, because you know, we have to say what it is. There are some people that still look upon science fiction, even though we have had some films like Alien and. So many groundbreaking science fiction works, but a lot of Star Trek was seen as kids' television. You know, now we know as people that know it inside and out that it dealt with enormous issues, and they were essentially morality plays. You know, and look, we can intellectualize the brilliance of Star Trek as much as we like, but it is about a load of people of aliens on a spaceship, and you know, it for some people they would put it probably in their perception. Star Trek is the same as, you know, pigs in space. You know, it's just fantasy. It's not proper acting, is it? And I beg to differ. But then, of course, you know, we appreciate different kind of art forms. And there are some people that simply, there'll always be that character from Star Trek. There are some people, however, that have done extremely well. There were plenty of people that wanted to be guest stars because they were bigger than the show. Look at Whoopi Goldberg, for example. I discovered the other day that Robin Williams was meant to be a guest star but never was. Did you know that?
Yeah, he's supposed to be in Metal Perspective.
Yes.
I think, yeah. He's supposed to be playing the time traveler thief.
He was, and instead it was the guy from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. I can't remember his name.
He's
Neighbor.
Matt Favreau.
Is that it? Matt Favreau. Yeah, that sounds about right. I don't know. gosh, it's like I could see your whole Elcar's computer system in your eyes then. I'm trying to think who. What's quite funny is when you meet people who've forgotten they're in Star Trek. That's one of my favourites. I remember when I was running the Landor Theatre in South London, Stephanie Beecham came in.
Oh, bless.
Well, you know, Steffi Beecham is an icon. And I was, because I ran the theatre, I think I bought her a drink or something, we were chatting. I said, I loved you in Star Trek. And she went, how on earth do you know I was in Star Trek? I said, you know. You know, it's all storytelling. It's all storytelling. And I think actually what those guys were doing back, especially in the 90s, you know, seeing, I mean, no wonder they had a laugh. Because imagining what it must have been like being the director going, right, guys, now this is when the, let me just check the script. This is when the Borg cube, this is when it hits the ship, right? And what we're going to do is we're going to shake the cameras. Cool. Okay. You guys know how to do that? Of course, season 5. Okay, right. Well, then, all right, guys, the Borg cube hitting, you know, bless them. They must have had the time of their lives. And I also know from some of them, particularly in the later series, the guys in the makeup, especially, when I learned that they were working sometimes 12, 14 hours, that's when actually, regardless of whatever you think of it artistically, just as workhorses, you know, that amount of time away from your family, that's brutal. That is a brutal thing. But hey, as Dominic always says to me, you know, that's the house that Trek built, you know, as he sits in the pool, because, you know, it paid well.
Yeah, I guess that's at the end of the day, it's for professionals, even though we think them as, you know, they are the characters, they bring the character to life, but at the end of the day, it's a show business that they have to work in to, you know, to pay their bills, pay their mortgage, and get food in the table, and, you know, just like, you know, people have to serve coffee in the coffee shop because that's how we do our answering phones, because that's how we get money into our pocket. So it is, yeah.
But not only that, my favorite thing is when it's like the little right is as I've seen. I'm not going to name any names. But where you've still got, you know, the rivalry between some of the shows as well, you know, like who's going to be billed where, and, you know, whose show is successful, who's a captain, who's not a captain, you know, all this. I mean, the film for me, the greatest Star Trek film that wasn't a Star Trek film was Galaxy Quest, because I think it's pretty damn accurate to some of the experiences, you know, and, you know, they're just... jobbing actors. And actually, I think what's really, really bloody lovely is when I am working with them and on things that are not Trek, you know. It is really nice just finding out what makes them tick as artists, you know. And I think sometimes this is not a reference to Marina in any way, shape or form, I hasten to add, but other people that come to mind, you know, I can see a slight sadness in their eyes when they leave the stage door and they have to sign up with them in a spacesuit and they've just come off stage for 2-3 hours. There is a slight sadness I've seen in some of them. Because actually, although actually Marina, very...
she must be chuckling now.
Signed Star Trek pictures. We chatted about it and she'll sign a program or I'll sign a ticket stub. She said, because I'm only signing things for people who come and see the play. And that just shows. And that, because she's theatre through and through. She was always a theatre girl. But that was in relation to Marina and stuff. That is another actor I was thinking. It's Patrick Stewart. Patrick Stewart, for example. You know, yes, he's very proud of Picard suddenly. But if you had gone to a stage door with a picture of Captain Picard after he's just come off stage doing something like Waiting for Godot, you can't help but feeling be a little bit frustrated. But
I guess that's it. I mean, he was always really big advocate of, like, you know, I'm more than just Captain Picard, and, you know, I completely understand that, you know, he's being the main character, one of the main lead character in the show, and, you know, people are obviously looking up to him because he was so many things for so many people. Obviously, over the 30 plus years, he answered all of these questions multiple times, and I think, bless him, Brent Spiner probably the same as well.
Yeah,
I remember I did not ask him Star Trek questions when I met him. I really was just curious about how he felt. What was he playing with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau in Out to Sea, which was a fantastic movie, and he happened to be in it, and with two icons that I'm never gonna have the chance to meet, but I would have loved if I'd born in 50 years earlier or something. But it's crazy.
I've always said that Brent Spiner was Star Trek's greatest gain, but musical theatre's greatest loss. Because he was a damn fine Sondheim musical theatre performer. You can see him in Sunday in the Park with George, and which is my favourite musical, I hasten to add, Sondheim, and James Pine. And I think if Brent hadn't gone down the television route, I'd like to think. That we would have seen him do a lot more Stephen Sondheim musicals, because he was a bit good at them. He really was. And he had a... Yeah, in fact, funny enough, he's a big fan of the Fimbra Theatre, which is a tiny 50-seat theatre in Earl's Court that I used to be an associate director. Mm-hmm. And I know he's in touch with the Fimbra a lot. He wants to do something there. So you never know. Maybe one day I'll do something with Brent Marina. Who knows? Maybe that's the next thing I should look at. Brent Marina.
Maybe. Who would be your go-to? Who would be the one ideal dream person to work with from Star Trek? Any of these actors?
I've already worked with it, Marina Sirtis. So I'm going to do Marina Sirtis in Hamlet. I'm going to do... what else are we going to do? We'll do Marina Sirtis in Jesus Christ Superstar.
So have a part for Marina for sure.
Apart from Marina, who would be my star? I think Johnny Phillips is a damn fine actor, and I mean he's done a lot on Broadway. I think Ethan Phillips. Sorry.
I kind of kept thinking like, who's Johnny Phillips? Is
Johnny? Sorry. Ethan Phillips, because I think Ethan Phillips is a damn fine stage actor. I would love to do. I would love to. If I can do one shout out, it's to Kitty Swink and Armin Shimerman's theatre. Guys are doing everything at the moment to keep that going. So after you've bought my print, then please go and support Armin and Kitty's theatre. I want to call it the Artemis Theatre, but it's not the Artemis Theatre. It's called something else. It's gone out of my head. No. I'd love to go and help them out. They do like Great American Classics, but they're really working hard to keep that place going. It's sort of wrong because it's rare. Marina is probably one of the only people, maybe she is the only person. Marina's the only person that I went out shopping for a play for an actor. Normally I find the play and then I choose the best actor. Do you know what I mean? But Marina, I just sort of was like, because I remember her saying to her, why have you not done the West End? Because I offered her a job years ago via her agent, and she went, I didn't know about it, and I believe her. And it was a play called Conjugal Rights. Thank God she didn't do it, because the play was dreadful. But it was really turned out the worst play I've ever done in my life. She was my first choice, and they sent it to the agent, and I think the agent looked at it and went, oh, she's in LA, she won't want to do it. So it never got to her. So it was only when I met her and I said, I offered, that was it. I said, I offered you a job. You never said yes. I never heard of it. And I said, well, why didn't you want to do the West End? She went, I'd love to do the West End. And then discovered various things that the agent wasn't necessarily aware of what she wanted to do British stage. Mm-hmm. And then, rather lovely to give her that opportunity. What, one of the happiest things ever. Actors I'd love to work with. It's interesting looking at the great stage actors who happened to do Star Trek over the years. Mm-hmm. You've interviewed Bob Picardo. Funny enough, when we were doing Dark Sublime, at the same time, my pal Terry, who played Davros in Doctor Who, he was doing a show with Robert in the Edinburgh Fringe, and it was something to do with doctors. and apparently he had a screen doing that. It depends. I mean, to be honest with you, the people I know from the show, if there's something right, then I'd call them and say, do you want to read this? And if they wanted to do it and they could afford to do it, then they would. I think the thing at the moment that's really important as well is it's all very well talking about these established actors, but don't forget I have a production company that is very much focused on supporting new and emerging talent, and talent, and in particular those from cultural and ethnic minority backgrounds. So you know, Dark ticked lots of boxes for me because it was a great play about lesbians. You know, that's why I loved it, and not just lesbians, but lesbians over the age of 50, because you know, there's lots of lovely plays about sexy young lesbians that are discovering themselves, but actually, you know, women in their autumnal years who are funny, not as common. That was the challenge with Dark Sublime, finding consummate stage actors who were women who also had the technique and the craft to make a comedy work. And fortunately, you know, I was spoiled for choice with the people that I saw, and indeed the people that I cast. And you know, if I had my time again, every single one of those actors would get exactly the same job again. No regrets there whatsoever.
And so I wonder, because I'm not sure if any of my audience member will recognize the play itself. Is it available anywhere to buy, or is it just only
It is, and I'd love to tell you. Because it would be lovely. Because I know lots of fans have bought it. It is published by Nick Hearn Books, and it's called Dark Sublime. It's by Michael Dennis, and it's available to buy the paper version of the play. And if you buy it, of course, you will open the page, and on the very first page, you'll have the original director and the original cast, which is rather lovely. And it's also got the original artwork that we use from the show. And what is a really, really lovely treat. I mean, as a director, especially as a single gay director, you know, the idea of legacy is quite important to me through my work. And it's a really lovely thought to think one day, you know, I'll be an 80-year-old director in a cardigan somewhere, and you know, there in a drama school library somewhere will still be Dark Sublime, originally directed by Andrew Keats, originally starring Rena Sirtis, Sophie Ward, Quakey Mills, King, Mark Gatiss, Simon Thorpe. That is, you know, that's
immortality.
Immortality. And that's remarkable.
So I think we arrived in a stage in our podcast where I have to put, because you're an actor, I have to put you in a spotlight. We have a little segment called Do Your Shat, which is a William Shatner impression game.
Well, I've got the chair. Yeah.
So you can say anything or whatever comes to your mind, even the opening sequence from Star Trek itself. And
exactly what I'm going to do. Stay there. Stay there one second. I'm going to take my copy of Dark Sublime.
Oh boy.
Wasn't it? I'll read a bit of Dark Sublime shy in style of The Shat. Yes, I do. This is one of Marianne's lines. She was off stage at this point. Let's do some chat. I haven't really got a favorite story. I didn't want you see. You'll find very few actors that enjoy watching themselves. Actors are very insecure about. Let me tell you, maybe that's not a surprise to you. They are a lot to be insecure about, you might think. And in that case of a rather well-known chap who's currently getting away with murder in the Little League each evening and twice at weekends, you'd be right.
There you go.
That was epic.
Great, 6 years.
That was really good.
Thank you very much.
It was a very reminded me of Kevin Pollak's Shatner impressions.
Well, do you know what? I had a party the other day. I had a small social gathering, which me and my friend, and I put on Shatner's because he didn't believe it existed. I put on Shatner's Common People. I want to live like common people. I want to do what common people do. I mean, look, the Shatner is the Shatner. He's, you know, I'm not really an autograph hunter. I don't really have autographs. But I do have a signed William Shatner autograph that Dominic Keating brought back for me. And Dominic said to me, it's all about impersonations today. I got Shatner to personalize it for you.
It's a big deal because he doesn't do that.
He's like, and he don't personalize for nobody, but I said who you were and he personalized it. Anyway, how about that? I do have a signed William Shatner, but I think he's, you know, he's an extraordinary gentleman. He's an extraordinary
I'm just kind of thinking, like, how was it like William Shatner get approached by Dominic Keating, like, hey, can you sign this for my friend?
I think they were just in the green room. They were just in the green room, and Dom did it. It's very, 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 very sweet. I may be wrong here. I can't remember. I think Shatner made him pay for it as well. Maybe I'll let Dominic off another week staying on my sofa. Oh boy, good Quantum Leap reference.
Oh my days. Oh gosh. So. Okay, so go back to a bit of a serious side of things. So aside being a director, a theater performer, and an artist,
not a performer.
Oh my! So that's my bad. But right. you performed in Board Blanket, so you're a performer now.
I know how to tell a story. Basically, I like the rehearsal room. I just can't be asked to do a show 8 times a week. I just haven't got that. That's the main reason. I've been asked quite a few times to be in things, and I've just gone, it just doesn't really send out the right message to, you know. I there's lots of people who go, I'm an actor, I'm a director, I'm a writer, I'm a producer, and I'm sort of like, no, I make shows. That's what I do. Mm-hmm. I make shows. And I help actors be better actors. That's my job. I'm really good at it, and I don't want to be a jack of all trades. I want to be the best director I can possibly be, and you know. But then who knows? A friend of mine.
I do have to say that you're a bit of everything, because you do your podcast as well, the Show People podcast. Tell a little bit about my audience about the Show People podcast.
The Show People podcast with Andrew Keats. Mm-hmm. The Show People podcast with Andrew Keats, which is available to listen to on all good podcasting platforms, mm-hmm. was my response to a very dear friend of mine who said, Andrew, can I meet up and talk about my career? Which was code for her saying, Andrew, can I meet up and can I just cry on you because I haven't had an audition for a year? Oh. And bless her, we did meet up, and she was working every hour God sends mm-hmm. in the centre. And I said, look, you know, at the end of the day, what makes you an artist is not when you're working. It's when you're connected with other artists and other creative people, and how you can fill each day with a creative challenge. Because what I find, speaking for myself and knowing others feel the same, for me, it's about having an idea, going through a process and having a result. Mm-hmm. And satisfying to a creative person. Now, you can do that making a loaf of bread. Mm-hmm. And you can satisfaction from that, so I was giving my advice to my friend, and I said, like, do some masterclasses, do a small fringe show, you know, join a play reading group. And she said, Andrew, I just don't have time. And she began to cry. Mm-hmm. And I realized that my friend was in an impossible situation, that she was working for little to no money every hour God sends, and I didn't know how my production company could help her. Mm-hmm. And then I asked her, I said, where is it? And it was in the arse end of nowhere in East London. She had to travel for about an hour a day. So that was in my head. And then I was listening to, I think it was the National Theatre podcast, and there was some director more boring than me going on about, you know, oh, well, you know, really, in Aeschylus's work, they're really predicting the immigration crisis. And this is tedious, boring, mm-hmm. academic to theatre. So that was it. But some interesting things, just a bit dull. Mm-hmm. And back then I used to listen to the Chris Evans Breakfast Show, which doesn't exist. Well, it does exist, but it's moved and it's changed. Mm-hmm. I was listening to that and I was like, theatre kind of needs something like that. It needs something that's interesting whilst at the same time doesn't take itself too seriously, and is an opportunity for me to not only look at the life of a performer, but the, you know, the bulk of most performers, it's been a struggle. It's not been, and then I arrived at the RSC and everything was fine. You know, everyone's had struggles, ups and downs, moments where they've been broke, moments where they've been rich, moments where, you know, they've lost everything. And so the Show People podcast was to go through an actor's entire life with games and stupid bits and pieces. Oh, thank you, Siri. Thank you very much, my Irish Siri. And it was an opportunity to go from the highs and lows, but with, you know, stupid games. I mean, I do a thing called Funny 5 Minutes, so I ask lots of rapid questions, like, you know, what's the strangest thing you've ever had in your mouth? And, you know, just silliness, as well as asking what it's like, you know, growing up as an abused child. But, you know, and we really go to places. And funny enough, a few Star Trek actors have done it for me. It's, as I said, it's a podcast. It goes out. It's suspended at the moment because, to be honest with you, with lockdown, I did a few via Zoom, but to be honest with you, it just wasn't of a quality that I was happy with. And if you're talking about very, very difficult things, it's the kind of chat that I really need to be able to top someone's glass of red wine up talking, and I miss that too much. But I'm trying to think, the Star Trek actors who've been on it, Terry Farrell has been on it.
Dominic was in.
Dominic was on it. He's coming home. Yeah, Dominic was on it. I had, who else has been on it?
I think Heath Connor as well, right?
I don't think I've ever interviewed
no?
Connor. If I have, I'm really sorry, Connor, if I've forgotten.
or maybe I didn't do my research well.
I had Gary Graham on it. I had Drones.
Oh, yeah, he's fantastic.
who else was there? For really, really bad, really, really bad. Why am I not remembering everyone?
That's fine. That's absolutely fine.
I've had lots of lovely side. But also, there's lots of people, again, who I'm probably not thinking of because I many know them from stage work. And they've also... Annette Badland's been on it. She was obviously in Doctor Who. But Annette is patron of my company, Arian Productions. So, and she was one of the Slitheen, I believe.
Oh,
let me get this right. Raxacodico Palipatorius.
I'm not sure.
Raxacodico Falipatorius.
She was in Boomtown as well. The episode Boomtown. She was the mayor of Cardiff.
She was. And did you know that she told me that Russell wrote that episode specifically for her?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I think it has the best scene of Christopher Eccleston scene in the whole series, in my opinion, is between him and Annette. When she's having her last dinner before her potential execution.
Oh yeah, that was a good scene.
And
I remember that.
But it is it's Annette's work in that, and Russell's writing that is extraordinary. If that's one thing I did do for lockdown, talking about the warm blanket feeling, I bought the other day, I bought Doctor Who on Blu-ray. Funny enough.
Oh boy.
Physical media. I bought the lovely box set of the three lads. On Blu-ray, and I really enjoyed. I went back and I started back at Rose, and the interesting sound issues that come with those early episodes. Wow, extraordinary that went out. But I've got to say, I mean, some of the best writing Doctor Who ever saw in those early episodes. So you know, it's that warm blanket feeling you're talking about. It's going back. It's when you look back at the show and you go, my God, the CGI is awful and the sound levels are terrible, but it doesn't really matter.
Exactly, just what I was about to say.
Doesn't really matter. In the same way that when I think of when you watch Voyager and you go, or Deep Space Nine or any of those, and you look at the colours of the show and you go, Christ, that was dingy, wasn't it? And yet, in my mind, it's the most vibrantly coloured show I've ever seen, I suppose, because I'm remembering it through the eyes of a young kid that had never seen anything like it.
That's beautiful. And I think that's probably the best and most beautiful point to bring this podcast.
That's more than pop a cup there.
Yeah, well, Andrew... It was a fantastic chat. I really enjoyed it. It was a blast to get to know a bit more about you and your industry, and then of course your connection to Star Trek. And I'm very glad that you you know, to spend that time with me and my audience. It's really a privilege, honestly.
I'll be honest with you, Gary. What's been rather nice, as I said, you know, I live on my own apart from me and my cat Toby. So I'm amazed to make an appearance. Usually he crashes all podcasts that I do, and I encourage it. But it's been very nice. It's been very nice to feel like I'm just geeking out with you know, another fan, because I'm sat at my table in my great big leather chair, and I just felt like I've had a lovely chat. So it's a shame we didn't have a couple of beers and we weren't in a pub doing it. But you know,
well, then next time, once this whole craziness go, next time.
Absolutely,
yes. For sure. This was lovely. I completely, so at one point I forgot that I'm doing a podcast.
Me too. Absolutely. But it's been nice. It's also been nice to, you know, it's been nice to bring back a lot of very happy memories during a time where it's very difficult to make some happy memories. And also, you know, nice to put some, to finally get some skeletons out of my closet. You know, people have asked me, why are you not involved with the Sci-Fi Ball? And I just go, well, you know, I don't work with them and I don't support. But actually, it's really nice to know that, you know, as I've said, people change. If that's one thing I've learned as I've grown older, people change, people's circumstances change, and you know, I will continue, even in this adversity, to work with people that I love and people that I believe in. And my advice for anybody else is, if you are in a job or you are in a relationship and you don't feel love and respect, then get the hell out. Because I promise you, there's better things you can do with your time.
If my audience members want to connect with you, want to follow you, or is there any way that they can connect with you or what you do? This is your chance to plug everything.
Sure,
that you can.
Sure. I'll plug everything. Right. So my Grindr profile is.
Oh my.
Yeah. NCC1701. The best way to get in touch with me is when it was, until we were all all hacked the other day, Twitter. So you can follow me on Twitter, which is at Andrew Keats. Sorry, I'll say that again as my computer makes noise. My Twitter is at Andrew Keats, and that's Andrew and Keats, K-E-A-T-E-S. I don't really connect with people on Facebook. As every time I connect with people on Facebook, I just tend to get messages from people that I purposely don't have in my phone book anyway. But Twitter is a really good way. The thing that I would really ask people to do, because I know we've had a laugh, but damn, it's tough, is go to my website, andrewkeats.co.uk. The A3 Spock and Kirk print is there. I'd love it if I could sell out. I think I've got 25 of them left at the moment. If I could sell those out, they're 30 quid each, which is nothing. If I could do that, well, that would pay my bills for the rest of the year. And and the Show People podcast, that's on Twitter at Show People UK. And if you want to find me, just go on Apple Podcasts or whatever good other podcast platforming are available. And that's available just by searching for The Show People podcast with Andrew Keats. And if it's about any work, please just contact my agent, which you'll find all the details on my website.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you very much for sparing your time and being in the Warm Blanket podcast. And for my listeners, thank you again for listening to another episode of the Warm Blanket podcast. And until next time, live long and prosper. And that was it for this episode. I really hope that you enjoyed it, and rest assured, new episodes will be coming out every week, where we sit down with a Trekkie to find out what makes us feel good about Star Trek and to discover what is our warm blanket made of. If you really enjoy listening to this podcast, please leave a review on your favorite podcasting app. It would really mean a lot to me. To find out more about this audio adventure, please visit trekkerprize.com/podcast, where you can also listen to the previous episodes. Thank you again for listening to yet another episode of the Warm Blanket podcast, and I'll see you in the next episode. Live long and prosper.